Welcome to the Lending Forward podcast, brought to you by Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group. This is your home for real discussions about the mortgage and housing industry. Our hosts are here bringing you firsthand accounts every week from people at the heart of the business. And we're chatting with professionals from all corners of the industry as they help cultivate transparency around the future of the industry we love. Together, we are lending forward all we know to you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Let's dive in.
I am joined with Amanda Tucker. She is our Chief Risk and Compliance Officer. Hey, Amanda.
I'm so excited to be here. This is actually my first time on Lending Forward.
First time guest, big time fan, right?
Yes, I listen to every podcast.
Well, awesome. Well, first, before we dig in, because there are a lot of regulatory changes that I want to talk through that are affecting loan officers and realtors. But before we dig in, if you don't mind giving us a little bit of your background, how did you end up in this space? What's kept you in this space?
Sure. So I've been with Atlantic Bay for almost 7 years now. My background prior to joining Atlantic Bay was on the large to mid-sized commercial bank side. And so previously working for publicly traded banks that had large mortgage divisions or subsidiaries. But I started my career as a bank regulator. I'm originally from Boston, and so I worked in Boston for several years, examining banks, credit unions, money service businesses, and of course, mortgage lenders. And I really got into this field through an internship. I did an internship with a county judge that led to an internship working for the Massachusetts Division of Consumer Affairs, and really just started to understand more around financial services and the regulatory side and sort of fell in love with it. But I got tired after a few years doing regulatory exams and wanted to work for a company and help them do it the right way versus going into companies and telling them everything they're doing wrong. So I've been in the space for about 20 plus years now and absolutely love it. I love working on regulatory compliance and risk management programs, more so trying to understand how to comply, but also appreciating that this is a business and we need to run, grow, and build the business. And so hopefully helping the company meet in the middle on those two things.
That's a big background. I agree. I'm glad you're here because you're helping us navigate through a lot of these things. And that's going to take me right into our favorite topic, which is the NAR lawsuit. You know, we all know that the guidelines or VA's guidelines have been revised. There's still just a lot of talk and rumors and gossip and confusion just all over the board. I think every day you hear something new and you really just don't know if it's fact or fiction. So before I dig into some of my questions, can you real quickly just summarize what we are expected to see happen this month?
Yeah, so this month we will see NAR operationalize their guidelines specific to MLS listings. So this will largely entail the elimination of their participation rule, which previously required seller agents to offer buyer agents compensation. And so you'll see that rule eliminated and you'll see these new guidelines take effect in August. So sellers can still absolutely offer buyer credits that then can be applied to buyer agent compensation, but it has to be voluntary and it has to be done outside of the MLS. And then, of course, as you mentioned, one of the biggest changes that we saw in June, which takes effect in August, it was on August 12th specifically. So the Department of Veterans Affairs announced a temporary local variance that would allow veterans to pay reasonable and customary amounts for any buyer broker charges, including those commissions and other broker related fees. And so it's subject to certain safeguards, but this was really a critical change because previously veterans could not offer compensation. And so what you would see at times happen is a veteran would begin working with their buyer broker agent, they would go to make an offer, offers accepted, they come to get their mortgage loan. And the fact that they may have already committed to paying certain buyer broker compensation would automatically preclude them from being able to seek a VA product or program. So this is a really impactful change that we're expecting this month, tied really to the NAR lawsuit.
And that is a positive change. I mean, that sounds like it's going to open up the door to veterans across the country. Yeah. That's awesome.
It's going to eliminate a lot of the challenges that we see at times in a transaction from a product program standpoint. It's going to allow that veteran at the outset of seeking a home to really go into it with transparency and to have a lot of options, especially if they find a home where their brokers help them find the home, but the seller doesn't want to pay the full buyer broker compensation. So this really just opens a lot of doors for our veterans, but also for us as mortgage lenders.
For sure. So you mentioned the compensation, it can't be on the MLS. So what is that the most important change to the MLS? What should the loan officers listening really be paying attention to this month?
So the biggest change is that properties that are on the MLS listings or any listings that are owned by NAR or NAR affiliates cannot have any display of information on agent compensation. So for us as lenders, as we are working with our borrowers, especially borrowers who are coming to us through a realtor referral, understanding if that seller has contractually committed to paying any part of the buyer broker compensation, or if the borrower is going to make up some of that compensation. That's one of the things that we need to understand at the outset. We've seen in recent months some loan transactions where you get in the middle of the loan is set to close, we have borrowers ready to move into their new home, and all of a sudden it's identified that the seller's not paying the full buyer broker compensation, and now our buyer has to bring additional cash to closing. And at times that is a surprise during the transaction that causes a delay in closing. And that's not something we want, especially since a lot of these borrowers are first-time home buyers and this is a purchase transaction and they need to move into that home.
So are you coaching loan officers? Are you talking to the loan officers at Atlantic Bay about how to have those conversations up front? Or is there advice that you would give to the loan officers listening? It sounds like you want to have this conversation as soon as possible. How do you have this conversation and when?
Yeah, so we're working with our loan officers to understand, one, are they in a state where a buyer agency agreement is required? And if the buyer agency agreement's required for you as the loan officer, asking for that agreement at the outset. So before you even begin to take the 1003, pull credit, move it into underwriting for an approval, asking for that buyer agency agreement, because that really is going to tell you if the borrower has committed to paying the buyer broker any type of compensation that would not customarily be paid or offered to be paid by the seller. Also, you know, if they found a home and there's a sales contract, understanding what the seller will be responsible for. We always want to have that information at the outset, but I think in the current environment with so much confusion, with sellers kind of pausing and saying, look, I now understand I don't have to pay for the buyer broker's compensation, I'm only paying 3% and that's going to my seller's agent. You know, we're seeing a lot of that happen in transactions. So as much information you can get about, you know, who's getting paid what and who's paying who at the outset, I think creates a smoother process for our borrower.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you just nailed it. There's still so much confusion out there around seller concessions and around IPC. So can you provide a little clarity around the agency's guidance on IPCs?
Yes. So IPCs, which are our interested party contributions. So those are the costs that the buyer's generally responsible for, that third parties such as the seller, for example, would pay. And so what we saw earlier this year is FHFA, so Fannie Freddie, FHA, USDA, and then of course, VA, all issued guidance clarifying. So again, this was a clarification. This wasn't new guidance, but clarifying that seller concessions specific to buyer broker commissions are not considered IPCs. That means they're not subject to each of those agencies' respective IPC threshold. And so one of the things that we saw with this clarification that was so impactful is there was so much confusion out there. You had realtors understanding that sellers paying the buyer broker compensation would now be considered in the IPC threshold. That's never been true. That's not true. Absolutely still open to negotiation, has no impact on the IPCs. So that's something that we spent a lot of time with our loan officers here at Atlantic Bay, kind of talking through, working through, putting out content, going back as early as April this year. But I would say this week alone, I've seen 7 questions on IPCs. And those questions aren't really coming from our loan officers. They're coming from realtors that they work with who are hearing this through, I think, you know, just various industry guidance. And so there's still a lot of confusion out there.
Yeah, there is. And you might not have the answer to this, but is there a source of truth somewhere? So if you are hearing all of the gossip and you're not sure, is there a place that people can go to read the facts?
Yeah, so great question. I know for our teams and for the information and content that Atlantic Bay is putting out, we're using one, kind of the agency issuances. So the agency updates, the FAQs, the mortgagee letters, anything coming directly from the GSE. We're also using the National Association of Realtors FAQs on the settlement. And so that's, I think one of the things that we're seeing is as information makes its way from NAR down to the local chapters, we're starting to see some confusion, miscommunication. So I know internally our legal team kind of goes directly out to the National Association of Realtors. We've been really fortunate to have some great relationships there to also seek clarification when we hear some of that misinformation.
Okay. Back to the confusion. I know we've run into this question a lot. So if you can also provide some clarification on whether or not a lender can finance the buyer broker commission into the loan.
This is my favorite question. I think I hear it once a day, and sometimes it's coming from the same LO because they're hearing it so convincingly so from their real estate partner. Mm-hmm. So the answer is no. I mean, there's no financing of the buyer broker commission. It's not permitted by any of the GSEs under their respective guidelines. But we're also now hearing, you know, investors say they also will not permit the commission to be financed into the loan. But the other reason I think that this is something that I wish there was more conversation on in the industry, it's a math problem, right? So if you financing the commission into the loan, it's going to represent challenges under the points and fees test. So the points and fees test effectively places a 3% threshold, so 3% of the loan amount cap on points and fees that a borrower pays as part of the loan transaction, and it can't exceed that. So if you think of what your buyer broker compensation is as a percentage, as a dollar amount, you're going to hit that 3% threshold.
The math
doesn't work. And so then what you'll see is you'll have more non-QM loans, but you'll also have other issues passing all of the federal and state level tests that you have to pass to effectively originate the loan. So I know in a lot of our communications with RLOs, and in some of the industry outreach that Atlantic Bay is doing, we're trying to focus more so on, not only is this not currently permissible, but even if it were to ever become permissible, you're going to have all of these other issues. You're not going to see TRID updated to change the points and fees test. You're not going to see respective state laws change. So I think even if it was permissible, you're still not going to see it be feasible on the majority of transactions.
Mm-hmm. So this is really rumor mill, if you will. Like, this is where this came from. Like, there's absolutely no facts or anything that backs this up?
No, so I've heard the question a few times this week, I think from some of the LOs who have attended local real estate association chapter events. And like, this is mine, Amanda's kind of thought and feeling, having worked in the banking industry. My guess is a private commercial bank may say it's feasible if they are retaining that loan in their portfolio to service. So, I mean, that's an entirely different space than what, you know, independent mortgage banks, larger bank investors, anyone who is either retaining it for servicing or they're selling the loan on the secondary market, it's simply not going to be feasible.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So we have been hearing a new word that that throughout the industry that the buyer broker commissions should now be referred to as the buyer broker compensation. Do you have any insight on that?
So this one, we did chase this all the way down to the National Association of Realtors to ask them, is this information communication that you're putting forward? You don't see it anywhere on their website. You don't see it in their FAQs. But what they have said is that they are starting to see an increase in buyer broker agents referring to it as buyer broker compensation along with a professional fee. But both are still permissible. It can be referred to as buyer broker compensation, or it can be referred to as buyer broker commission. One of the other things too that we've heard this week is that realtors are indicating that the buyer broker compensation and a professional service fee has to be disclosed at the outset on the loan estimate. And so, I mean, that's not new. That's not different. We've always had to disclose that information in Section H. So we're kind of working through some of the questions, misinformation, miscommunication as it comes in. And, you know, here at Atlantic Bay, as you know, we have our newsroom NAR lawsuit article. That article updates as soon as new information comes in so that we can try and help clear up some of the misinformation that's out there.
So what I'm hearing, though, is that you could say you can interchange commissions and compensation, and it doesn't really matter. It's whatever the agent's comfortable with.
Yes. So from what we understand today.
Right.
I think that's the challenge with this is, you know, we'll look a month or two ahead at events or content we want to put out. And then we find that 24 hours prior, we're having to revise the content because it's changing that often. We've known, though, for months that August for the NAR lawsuit resulting impact is going to be a huge month. I think as we see these changes operationalized, as we see the requirements take effect, I think we're going to still see more confusion. And so our goal has really been to communicate with our LOs, give them content, give them information and tools that they can share with their real estate partners. Because at the end of the day, our focus is making sure that our borrowers have a seamless loan origination and we get them into their home.
Right. So for all of the loan officers and the real estate agents listening to this episode, what advice would you give them along all of the confusion, all of the NAR stuff? I'm hearing do your homework, but I mean, I want to hear it from you.
I think as you are encountering questions from your real estate partners, from your borrowers, from anyone in the industry that sounds to be at odds with what you've understood or heard, reach out and ask the question. You know, Atlantic Bay has great relationships with a lot of the IMBs in the industry. We're constantly communicating with each other. You know, have you heard this? How are you responding to this? Reaching out, asking your legal team, asking your compliance team, they likely have the knowledge or can help you get to the right answer. But again, using kind of your standard sources of facts. So your GSE publications and the National Association of Realtors FAQs. If it's happening, it's in those FAQs. If it's coming from NAR, it's there. They're not rolling out anything that they're not putting forward in a very public space.
That makes sense. Well, while I have you, obviously there's always regulatory changes. We're in a highly regulatory environment. We are not shy about having social media coaches come on, and we talk about social media a lot and how important it is to be on social media and how important it is to build your personal brand. And, you know, we talk about that a lot on this podcast. But since I have you, I wanted to also ask, you know, some compliance questions, because I know that there are some rules, just a few, that we have to make sure that we are complying with. So as far as, you know, as far as social media compliance goes, what areas of focus are the regulators focused on right now?
I think it's a great question. So the thing with social media that I think at times is a challenge is the regulations and regulatory guidance never paces the evolution of social media. And so that's one of the disconnects that we see, and we talk often with regulators around. We are, though, I would say in the last 6 to 9 months, seeing an increased focus on all of our state regulatory exams on social media marketing and advertising. So one of the things that we're seeing regulators focus on is ensuring that social content, specifically profiles, if you are a licensed mortgage loan originator and you are promoting that on your social media, you are required to adhere to state level advertising rules, but really specifically NMLS requirements. And so NMLS requires that you have clear information in your social media profile, everything from your unique identifier to the consumer access website to the information of the company to which you are sponsored. And so making sure that that is in your profile, it's prominent for any content that you're posting. I mean, but here's a perfect example of where the requirements are not really evolving with the platform. Instagram, for anyone who's ever tried to get their NMLS required content on their Instagram profile, I mean, it's not happening. There's not enough character.
There's not enough space.
Character space available. And so that's one thing that in recent examinations, we've really worked with regulators on, you know, look, we're trying to put the information in. Mm-hmm. It's not going to fit. What do you suggest? And so I think continuing to find opportunities to make sure that you're complying with those requirements, but also appreciating that there are going to be challenges. You know, one of the other things that we're seeing regulators focus on, more so under federal law and regulation, is unfair deceptive acts and practices, looking at social content for potential violations there. This is one of the most challenging regulations because it's not sticky, right? It's just that unfair deceptive acts and practices. Everyone's perspective on what that may be does vary, but really they're focused in looking at content to ensure is the content promoting a fair, consistent, and transparent advertisement. But I'd say they're mostly focused in the unfair deceptive acts and practices space if you're promoting a product or program. So if you're promoting a product or program and you promote only the positive aspects of the product or program, but you fail to disclose minimum credit score, certain other qualifying information, even something like this product or program is only available in certain geographies or certain states. So they really will look to make sure that any content put forward has the appropriate level disclosures. You're still in the same challenge, though. If you're using a social media graphic, 50% of your graphic could conceivably be your disclosure.
Right.
And so we are seeing some states where we're getting traction on kind of the one click to disclose concepts. So that's, you have your landing page where they can click on that landing page. It takes them out to the full disclosure, full product and program terms and conditions. And so that's been really helpful in recent kind of social media content.
Okay. So, are there any regulations or, you know, potential violations that you're seeing with personal brands? I know personal brands has been a huge topic. I know we push, well, we don't push them, but we talk about them. And I think, you know, that's something that has popped up all over the place this year. Are they looking at personal brands?
They are. So we are really seeing a focus at the state level during examinations on personal branding and really personal logos. And so, you know, I think from an industry perspective, we all appreciate that from a competitive, you want to build your personal brand, you want to build your business. So this really, quite frankly, right now is an element of doing so. And how do we support that? On the regulatory side, though, the challenge is they want to make sure that your personal brand and logo is not appearing on social content independent of your company information. So that's your company's name, your company's brand and logo, your company's NMLS. And so oftentimes when we're working with our LOs on their personal brand and logo, it's really working on the placement. You know, the two have to appear side by side, or the personal brand and logo appears just above the Atlantic Bay logo. We are having some states take issue or exception with the naming conventions of the personal brand or logo. Some states are very stringent and they do not want to see, you know, Amanda Tucker mortgage loans. They feel that that indicates that even if it's placed next to the Atlantic Bay logo and NMLS information, it indicates that I'm operating my own mortgage company that may be unlicensed. So that's really what they're focused on, is adequate disclosure and clear and transparent placement of those logos for NMLS licensing purposes. You know, one of the other things too that we see with states is the focus on net branching rules. And so they're really looking at that to say, okay, does this personal brand or logo in any way indicate that this loan officer is acting independent of the corporate entity? And I think, you know, we all know and understand it's your personal brand, it's your personal logo, right, how you're promoting yourself in your community. But a regulator comes in and looks at it and will say, okay, Amanda Tucker Lending, I don't see Atlantic Bay anywhere near her personal brand and logo. If I'm a consumer, I'm going to believe that I'm getting my home loan from Amanda Tucker Lending. And so that's where we see kind of that focus. And you know, the challenge here is the cost of compliance. If you have a violation cited, and this is one of the things that we really talk with our LOs about, not to scare anyone, but the regulators at times will look to place a penalty or enforcement on the individual LO and their license. And at that point in time, you know, we absolutely do our best to help the LO, but that's, you only have one license. That's right. Your business. That's how you feed your family. So just being really protective of that. But, you know, the cost of a net branching violation, a state advertising or marketing violation, or an NMLS violation, it's significant. I mean, you're easily looking at $25,000 per instance. So if you're someone who has a really robust social content, depending on the state, it can get really expensive.
So you're saying that they are, I don't want to say going after, but the violations are coming to the LO and the company, or the LO and only the LO?
We are seeing both in certain states. We are seeing, though, and to be fair, you know, we are seeing some state regulators where there is an opportunity to remediate a finding or violation. And so they give you an opportunity to go out, have a conversation with the LO, make the necessary changes. But nearly every company is going to have a brand guideline. They're going to have kind of a toolkit to comply, making sure that you understand your company's brand guidelines, your company's compliance policies around this is so critical. Your compliance team is really there to help you design your personal brand and logo so that it is compliant.
Yeah. So takeaway here is to work closely with your marketing and compliance team so that nobody gets in trouble.
And look, I will say this, because we get a number of tickets that come into the team, and they do such a fantastic job of, like, you know, we always see it. And even if we're thinking there's no way we can do this, really getting in there and understanding more to work with the LO. No one wants to say no. We understand that this is so important in the industry to building your business.
Yeah.
Our requirements that we do have to make sure that we comply with.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you coming on to the podcast. I know, you know, compliance isn't the most fun topic, but it is the backbone of everything we do. And we wouldn't be here without you and other compliance departments across the country. So thank you for keeping everybody in business. But I can't let you leave without asking you, how are you going to lend it forward in the rest of 2024?
So I'm going to go back to the beginning when I was giving a little bit of insight into my background. I am incredibly passionate about intern programs in general, but really Atlantic Bay's intern program. I truly am so grateful for the experiences I had. I think I really do credit it with where my career has evolved and grown. And so for the remainder of this year, we here at Atlantic Bay, and really specifically in my department, have two fantastic interns, and we are so excited through the remainder of the year to continue to work with them as they enter their fourth year of school. So in terms of lending it forward, it's really going to be focusing on helping mentor and support kind of that next generation of mortgage industry professionals, whether they want to do the fun area of compliance or not.
Well, thank you so much, Amanda. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you. This has been great. I appreciate it.
See ya.
Bye.
Thanks again for tuning into today's episode of the Lending Forward podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our channel, follow us on Instagram at Lending Forward, on YouTube and LinkedIn. Tune in next week for another new episode and go lend something forward today. Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, LLC, NMLS number 72043, NMLSConsumerAccess.org is an equal opportunity lender and employer. Located at 600 Lynn Haven Parkway, Suite 100, Virginia Beach, Virginia 23452.